I'd like to introduce my close colleague and good friend, Stuart Rothoff. A year and a half ago, I guess it was, I took over the presidency of the Southern Jewish Historical Society from Stuart, who has had a brilliant two-year run, completely overhauling our website, by the way, since that's a big point of conversation here. And in my first presidential letter, I said, did anybody notice how big Stuart's feet are? It felt like it was going to be so hard to do all that he did has done for the SJHS. Stuart and I both are professional historians who've become public historians, so we have a lot of affinities. I'm going to read for you his official bio, just so you know how well-educated and distinguished he is. Stuart Rothoff was born in Fort Worth and raised in Houston, Texas. He graduated from Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, with a BA in history, and received his PhD in the history of the United States from the University of Texas in Austin, with a special emphasis on immigration and American Jewish history. He's taught several courses in American and ethnic history at the University of Texas and Millsaps College. From 2002 until 2013, he served as the director of the history department at the Goldring Waldenberg Institute of Southern Jewish Life in Jackson, Mississippi. And for those of you, David, among others who may not know, that's Macy Hart's organization. So Stuart was the worker bee that made Macy look so good for so many years. In November 2013, Stuart became executive director of the Mississippi Humanities Council, where he works to develop and support public humanities programs around the state. Dr. Rothoff lives in Jackson with his wife Susan and their two daughters, one of whom is planning a bat mitzvah.
Well, we're planning it. She needs to study her Torah portion.
So please welcome Stuart Rothoff.
Thanks, Thank you.
I'm embarrassed that we've used that very empty thread. If you don't study, then we're not going to have the bat mitzvah. Of course, we've already signed a hotel contract, catering, but anyway. I've been told this is not an unusual phenomenon, so I'm not worried. Thank you so much for having me here. It is a true pleasure. In my new job at the Humanities Council, I don't get to travel outside of the state as much as I used to, so getting a chance, I mean, not to defame Holly Springs, Mississippi, and Hattiesburg, Mississippi, they're lovely places, but Charleston is a bit lovelier, so I'm really excited to be here. And I'm really excited to be here as part of the 20th anniversary of the Historical Society. And I think in a lot of ways, what you have achieved in your time is quite extraordinary. And as Dale indicated, we are very involved in the Southern Jewish Historical Society. And we are quite envious of what y'all do here in South Carolina. And so what was interesting yesterday, it was really great to hear that panel with all the past presidents talking about the sort of reasons why the society was created. And in a lot of ways, it sort of leads into perfectly what I'm going to talk about this morning, and that is the sort of demographic changes that have occurred in the South that have affected the Jewish communities over the last several decades. The sort of decline of small towns, and the sense that this history was being lost. And that's why we needed to create the society to help preserve that history. So I think you'll see a lot of parallels in what I'm going to talk about this morning. And what I'm going to do is really kind of step back and give kind of a regional overview of these trends. That's kind of a fancy way of saying I'm not going to talk about South Carolina a lot, a little bit, but certainly hopefully at the end we can discuss about how, talk about how South Carolina's communities fit into these trends that I'm going to lay out for you. And I'm going to give you a bit of a warning. There are going to be numbers in this talk, but you know, one can't talk about demographics and economic trends without using some numbers. So to help offset that, I wanted to start by telling you a story. And the story relates to one of the students I taught back in my, I guess, post-grad school days. I taught at UT Austin for a couple of years. And there I taught a student who was a Jewish young woman from Cleveland, Mississippi. And at that time, I'm not even sure I knew there was a Cleveland, Mississippi. I thought Ohio. But her name was Carla Levingston, and I think her story in some way encapsulates what I'm going to talk about. So I want to begin with her. Carla was a very, very proud Southerner. Her great-grandparents had come to the Mississippi Delta around the turn of the 20th century. Her family, in fact, her parents still live there today. Her grandparents owned a retail store in the small Mississippi town of Ruleville. Who's heard of Ruleville, Mississippi? It's the hometown of Fannie Lou Hamer, actually. If you're ever there, they have a wonderful statue of Fannie Lou Hamer. That's neither here nor there. Well, it's there in Cleveland, I guess. Carla was born in Cleveland in the 1980s, and her family were one of the few Jewish families left in town. There was a congregation, there still is a congregation in Cleveland called Adeth Israel. When Carla was growing up, they had about three or four other families that had kids. And so every Sunday during the school year, they would gather in the small synagogue to receive Sunday school instruction as sort of a one-room schoolhouse, all the ages together in one room with their rabbi, Rabbi Moses Landau. Carla had no Jewish friends in her sort of regular school. Her only Jewish friendships came from her experience at the Henry S. Jacobs camp. The Macy was the director of it for 30 years in Utica, Mississippi, where my daughters will be in a few weeks. They're very excited. I'm not sure how to work on the tour portion, but we got to make sure she tutors while she's there. I'm sorry, I'm obsessed with this. And so Carla's experience of growing up in this small town, of having very limited Jewish social life outside of that camp experience, was very typical for Jews in the South after World War II. When she graduated from high school, Carla's parents urged her to leave Mississippi. They didn't want her to go to Ole Miss because there were not enough other Jews at Ole Miss. They wanted her to go somewhere that had a large Jewish population, which no school in Mississippi had. And so she went to the University of Texas, where she was forced to take my class, or she chose to, actually. Carla joined a Jewish sorority, and for the first time had a very vibrant, large Jewish social life. She went to graduate school in New Orleans, and after she finished getting her master's in social work, she got to decide where she wanted to move. And she never really considered going back home to Cleveland. In fact, her parents didn't really want her to come back home to Cleveland. The town has about 14,000 people. It's actually, you know, for Mississippi Delta, it's kind of a vibrant little town. But there were very few, if no other, single Jews in the town. Carla was single. Her parents wanted her to move somewhere where she could meet a Jewish man, get married, and have kids. And according to her Facebook page, she has, and she does. Apparently. She moved to Atlanta instead, which is now a mecca for young Jews. And she met her Jewish husband, and they are raising very few kids. Again, if Facebook photos are any indication of this. Meanwhile, the Mississippi Delta, Carla's home, has fallen deeper into economic decline, and its Jewish communities have continued to shrink. So in many ways, Carla's journey from the small town of Cleveland, Cleveland, Mississippi, to the very large, growing city of Atlanta, Georgia, encapsulates the story of Southern Jews since 1945. Large Southern cities like Houston and Atlanta, Nashville, Charlotte, have attracted a growing number of Jews from the South and from other parts of the country, as we'll see, while small towns have witnessed an exodus of their Jewish population. So what's interesting is that there's a lot of attention, you know, paid to the shrinking Southern Jewish communities, when in fact, there are more Jews living in the South than ever before, and I'm not even counting Florida, which I could, and I would completely prove it. But let's exclude Florida. Even without Florida, that is true. And so this is a time period where you see kind of a boom and a bust going on at the same time. So it's sort of a seeming contradiction. It's sort of a simultaneous, if you will, fall and rise of the Jewish South. So I want to talk a little bit about the economic changes that have sort of brought these trends to the fore. And indeed, a lot of attention, especially in this period when we're going through anniversaries of important civil rights events, a lot of attention has been paid on the far-reaching social changes that have taken place in the South after the civil rights movement. But perhaps less noticed have been the really revolutionary economic transformation of the South during the last part of the 20th century. While the economic dislocations of the Great Depression helped to sort of begin the process, it really was World War II that was the watershed event that helped revolutionize the South's economy. Its most dramatic effect was to drain the region's farm population. Between 1940 and 1945, 4 million people, or 25% of the South's farm population, left the farm, joining the army, joining the navy, or moving to the city to work in the booming war industries. And indeed, in the old industrial cities of the North and the Midwest, in the growing industrial cities of the South, these migrants found work and a healthier economy. And the South's farm population continued to decline after the war. In 1940, 42% of the South's population lived on farms. By 1960, only 15% did. Look at this amazing chart. I mean, I'm a whiz. Actually, since Mark left Jackson, I haven't been able to come up with good PowerPoint stuff. So blame Mark. All right, but the information here is very important. Also, this period, you see a real transformation in how farming is done in the South, with the rise of mechanization. In particular, where I'm from, Mississippi, it's the mechanical cotton picker, right? Cotton was a very labor-intensive crop. It required a lot of people to plant it, to chop it, and then to pick it. But once that could be done by machine, there was not the same need for labor. In 1950, 5% of the South's cotton crop was harvested by machine. So 95% was picked by human hands. By 1970, 98% was picked by machine. Right? This has a huge effect, especially on the Mississippi Delta, which I will talk about. Tractors and mechanical cotton pickers, again, led to important structural changes in the South's agriculture. Now, this going along with this, we see the rise in the South's urban population. Where are we? Look at this amazing chart. I mean, it's fantastic, isn't it? Anyway, that's why I say I know it's terrible. But it's clear, it shows, right? In 1940, about 26% of the South's population lived in what the census called an urban sort of metropolitan area. So about a quarter in 1940. By 1960, this was almost up to 50%. In 2010, 76% of the South's population live in urban metropolitan areas. And so the South in general is becoming more urban, less rural in terms of its population. And so it's the growing cities of the South that became the epicenter of the South's economic transformation away from farming towards industry and commerce. And by the 1970s, the national media has picked up on this, and they're beginning to write about the thriving Sun Belt, which they contrasted to the declining Rust Belt of the Midwest and the Northeast. And indeed, in the 1960s, for the first time in many, many decades, more people moved to the South than leave the South. There was an increase, in migration, or immigration out is larger than the out-migration. Now, as you probably know, not every part of the South took part in this economic boom. The historian David Goldfield has observed that the Sun Belt South, quote, was a crazy quilt of patches of prosperity, zigzagging between traditional areas of poverty. Indeed, the South's economic success story was largely restricted to its growing cities and suburbs. Other regions in the South were left behind. So all of these economic changes transformed the region's Jewish population. Now, certainly, you know, relatively few Jews engaged in farming, but the southern Jewish economy was in many ways closely linked to agriculture, right? And you all know this. Throughout the South, Jews settled in any sort of market town and opened often retail stores that catered to the area farmers, the area sharecroppers. But they were in those towns because those towns were important, sort of were tied into the crop. So in Lake Village, Arkansas, cotton was the crop. And so Lake Village was sort of a little market town, and Jews like Mr. Rosenzweig opened up a store there, catering to the folks who lived in that town and in the rural farming areas sort of around it. With these structural changes in the South's economy, Jewish merchants lost much of their customer base, right? I mean, today in Lake Village, Arkansas, you don't have the thriving downtown main streets that you used to have. I've been there, although there was a great place to get hot tamales in Lake Village, but that's all I can sort of tell you. for many, and there's dueling trends here. So, on the one hand, there's just much less economic opportunity in these small towns. At the same time as these changes are occurring, what's happening in the Jewish community is we're seeing, in a sense, kind of economic mobility, or I guess kind of professional mobility, right? The kids of and grandchildren of these merchants go to college and they become professionals. And they find their jobs in larger cities. I can tell you that the son of the owner of this store became a pediatrician and lived in Hot Springs, Arkansas. Joe Rosenzweig. In fact, when he was in Hot Springs, he was the childhood doctor of Bill Clinton when Bill was growing up in Hot Springs. So again, a very, very typical story. And so these two trends at the same time have led to a real decline in these small towns. It's not hard to see the impact of these demographic changes. Perhaps the most telling, I love these old store photos, right? Mm-hmm. Perhaps the most telling symbol of this decline is the closing of synagogues and the disbanding of congregations. Over the last few decades, many Jewish congregations in the South have been forced to close their doors due to dwindling membership. And this is just a few examples, but there are several more. Places like Wharton, Texas, Ardmore, Oklahoma, Helena, Arkansas, from this photograph, this was the very last service held at Temple Bethel in Helena. This is the last time that Torah was taken out of the ark there. And you can see, these sort of emotions of those who are taking part in this. Clarksdale, Mississippi, I will speak in a bit. Gadsden, Alabama, Weldon, North Carolina, Ashland, Kentucky, Suffolk, Virginia, among others. Even more than those who have closed, there are even more congregations that are facing the reality that in the future they may have to close. And so I know Sumter, South Carolina has been addressing this. I'm sure there were other examples in South Carolina as well, that in 20 years they may no longer be around. So I want to focus in detail on one region that I know a great deal about, and that is the Mississippi Delta. It's been called the most southern place on earth, and it's pretty southern, but it's also a really sort of clearest example of what I've described so far this morning. And I've got some cool pictures I want to show them to you. Jews flocked to the Delta as it emerged as the leading cotton-producing region in the country, beginning in the late 19th century. Jewish merchants and families opened stores in most every Delta market town. In 1937, the Mississippi Delta was home to 46 different Jewish communities, ranging from 450 Jews in Greenville to single families living in towns that were little more than wide places in the road, like Ruleville here. All told, over 2,000 Jews lived in the Mississippi Delta in 1937. Delta Jews formed cohesive social and also religious networks that brought together this dispersed population. Jewish families drove many miles to one of the seven synagogues in the Delta, which each served as sort of a regional synagogue. It served Jews from all of the towns around it. It was not unusual for Jewish teenagers to travel hours through the Delta's flat farmlands to attend balls like this and social mixers designed to introduce young Jews to potential spouses. It's a really interesting sort of Jewish social network that existed in the Delta. Now that is long gone. This region has seen a steep decline in its Jewish population. In 2013, and I'm estimating based on the folks I know, there are maybe 250 Jews remaining in the entirety of the Delta. They're scattered in eight different towns, eight different communities, all of which are declining. Several of those congregations have closed, and the remaining congregations are struggling to remain open. Few Jewish children raised in the Delta have stayed there. In many cases, as with my student Carl Levinston, the parents have discouraged them from returning. Again, a central concern is for their children to meet and marry other Jews, and that is really no longer feasible in a place like the Mississippi Delta, though it once was. In addition, the Delta has been hit hard by these economic changes. It is a very economically depressed region. There is just not much economic opportunity for enterprising business people. And so Here we see all those trends converge. We see Jewish retail business undermined by the general economic decline of the region. And one other thing I can mention, the rise of chain discount stores. The notion of small town, locally owned retailers is increasingly a thing of the past. So when you go through these Delta towns on the outskirts, you see the big Walmart, the big dollar store, and downtown is boarded up. Which has had a huge impact on these towns, and that's another talk. Empty storefronts line the main business streets. Jewish-sounding names are visible in sidewalk tiles in front of old abandoned buildings or sometimes empty lots. So if you walk through these towns, you can see evidence to the Jewish retailers' once prominence in these communities. Clarksdale, Mississippi is a great example of it. This is the Clarksdale Sunday School in 1939. You can see the number of kids that were there. Clarksdale was once home to one of the largest Jewish communities in Mississippi. According to a 1937 study, Clarksdale had 412 Jews, ranking just second, right behind Greenville. And as one of the mercantile centers of the most fertile cotton-growing region in the country, Clarksdale thrived in the early 20th century. You could walk down the main business streets and see, Jewish store after Jewish store. But with changes in the cotton economy and the general decline of the Delta, the town now is a shell of its former self. It's trying to, use blues tourism, because it's really central to blues history, as a way of bringing back the economy, and it still has a long way to go. Mirroring the decline of Clarksdale itself, the local Jewish community has withered to the point where the town's only congregation 10 years ago voted to disband and to sell its building. Here's a copy of the building. The last president of the congregation, Arnie Himmelstein, plans to leave Clarksdale once he retires. His children did not come back home after college. As he noted in an interview with the Forward newspaper, quote, "The young people didn't come back. They went places with more opportunities. You can't fault them for that." And indeed, this article has been written countless times about countless different towns. It seems like back in my old job, every few years, the Washington Post or the New York Times would contact us, having discovered this amazing story of the declining small town Jew. And it's been, of course, we always play along, we always help them because we want to get quoted in the New York Times. But what's interesting is that it's only part of the story. And certainly there are plenty of examples of the decline of these small towns. But there are exceptions, and they're interesting, and I want to talk about them, because some of them are like a trend, and some are kind of one of a kind. One of the exceptions to small-town Jewish life in the South declining are college towns. Increasing numbers of Jewish academics and professors are working at Southern colleges and universities in a way that they really weren't before, in the first part of the 20th century. It's led to the growth of Jewish communities and new congregations in college towns, places like Chapel Hill and Durham, although certainly there's more going on there than just a college. They are a key part of that. Knoxville, Tennessee has experienced quite steady growth from 800 Jews in 1960 to 2,000 Jews in 2010. In some cases, like Tuscaloosa, Alabama, what we've seen is a holding steady of their Jewish population, as essentially Jewish merchants are replaced by Jewish professors. And Tuscaloosa is interesting. This is the brand new synagogue dedicated a few years ago, Temple Amen Tuscaloosa. It is right in the middle of the University of Alabama's campus. The land for this temple was essentially given to the congregation on a $1 a year lease. And why would the University of Alabama want to have a synagogue in the middle of that campus? They want to increase their Jewish enrollment. They want to help recruit Jewish faculty. And so for them, they help with this. Right next door to it is a new Hillel building in Alabama. And so there's been a kind of concerted effort to increase the number. Auburn, Alabama, I learned that. Well, I know they have a relatively recently formed congregation and synagogue, but also the sort of administration of Auburn is also trying to encourage Jews. And in fact, bought bought a Hanukkah menorah, which they would then display during Hanukkah. So again, just to give Auburn and Alabama equal time, don't want to cause any trouble here. I'm just trying to stay out of it, all right? I'm not even getting to Clemson and USC, okay? Other examples. In the last few decades, new congregations have been established in Blacksburg, Virginia, Fayetteville, Arkansas, and Bowling Green, Kentucky. Here is Blacksburg, Virginia. It's the Blacksburg Jewish Community Center, they call it, but it's, you know, it's a congregation. They bought an old church. It looks like it's an old congregation. It's relatively new. My favorite fact is they bought this old church. The problem was, on the stained glass windows, there were crosses. So they painted it in some places with black electrical tape to add to it to make it less like a cross. So I take a close-up of that photo. Right? But the first ever Jewish congregation was established in Blacksburg, Virginia in just the last few decades. Again, because of Virginia Tech and the growing number of Jewish faculty. So we have college towns on one hand. The other sort of exception is retirement areas. And I know this for sure, but I'm willing to bet that the reason why the Myrtle Beach community has grown so much in the last 20 years is probably part of this phenomenon. My favorite example, though, is from Western North Carolina, Boone. In Boone, North Carolina, about 5 or 6 years ago, there were a number of Jews, and Boone's weird because it's a place where halfbacks go. You know what halfbacks are?
Yeah,
those are folks who have retired from New York to Florida. It gets too hot in Florida in the summer, so for the summer, they go halfway back and have a summer home in North Carolina. So in Boone, North Carolina, you have a mixture of year-round Jews, small number, who tend to be younger, have families, and then a large halfback population. And so a few years ago, there was discussion, they actually had a congregation, and the question was, do we build a synagogue? Now, some of the halfbacks figure, listen, I belong to my shul on Long Island for years, I belong to a shul in Boca, why do we need another shul? So there was some question. They actually got a lot of money from the owner of Claire's, the mall shop, to build this synagogue. Point. So they had a congregational meeting to decide whether to build a synagogue in Boone. It's called Temple of the High Country, by the way. This meeting has to be historically significant because that meeting took place in two places. It took place in Boone and in Boca Raton. This is the picture of the Boca Raton residents gathering, and they met via conference call, and they voted to, in fact, build a synagogue in Boone. And indeed, they have completed the synagogue. Temple of the High Country. Right? Other examples that one that's gotten interesting press is Dothan, Alabama. Who here has heard of the Dothan plan? Yeah. So here it happened in Dothan. In Dothan, there was a member of the Jewish community. Well, about 10 years ago, I actually spoke in Dothan. At the time, the congregation was small. There were maybe 5 kids in the Sunday school. They were shrinking, and they were, thinking about, well, what's our future going to be? There was a wealthy member of the congregation with very deep pockets who got the idea that, listen, I'll take $1 million and we will give an incentive for Jewish families to move here. So the idea was if we could get 20 Jewish families to move here, each of them could be eligible for up to $50,000. Now, not like in a big, suitcase full of cash, but the idea was that money could be used to cover your moving expenses, could be used to help buy a house, could be used to help start a business. So it wasn't just like, here's money, come on, but that we will help in those transition costs. And it was pretty successful. I mean, it was sort of like applying to Harvard. I mean, you had to apply, there were site visits involved, and it wasn't just, hey, I'm here, give me money. It was a whole process. And while during the economic downturn, it kind of stagnated a bit, it's been really going rather strong. Today, I just checked with my former colleagues at the Institute, there are over 20 kids now in the Dothan Sunday School. And the genius of it is, if 5 or 6 Jewish families move to Atlanta, there are drops in the ocean. If 5 or 6 Jewish families with kids move to Dothan, that's going to transform that Sunday school. It's going to keep it alive for at least another generation. So Dothan has been quite a success story. It is one of the communities that we work that the ISJL used to work. I used to work with the ISJL, but they still work with. In fact, that's one of our ISJL education fellows with kids from the Dothan Sunday School. Mark Swick was an ISJL education fellow.
Did you have a crown like that?
And so was Andrew Turkle, the new rabbi at KKBE, was an IS Twelve education focus. So you can see the influence. All right, Dothan. The other interesting example that I think is sort of the exception that proves the rule is Bentonville, Arkansas. Now, Bentonville, Arkansas, in 2004, about 30 Jewish families came together and formed the first ever Jewish congregation in that county, Benton County, Bentonville. The founders of Congregation Etz Chaim are not following in the footsteps of the roving peddlers who first settled in the small towns of Arkansas. Rather, they're drawn to Bentonville because, as some of you know, it is the home corporate headquarters of Walmart, the world's largest employer. Ironically, the same retail juggernaut that put so many small Jewish merchants out of business. Most all the members of Etz Chaim either work for Walmart or for Walmart suppliers. For example, Procter & Gamble. Their biggest customer is Walmart. They have an office in Bentonville, so they can work quite closely with Walmart. In fact, according to one of the founders of the congregation, one of the reasons why they created it was, quote, it would be an asset to the Walmart vendor community to have a Jewish community for recruitment, unquote. Trying to convince someone to move to Bentonville, the fact that there's a Jewish congregation would be beneficial to that. What's interesting about Bentonville is it started out, and this is their little not-too-exciting synagogue, and the thought was, of course, it would grow and it'd become this huge. It really hasn't grown because people cycle through. Folks spend 5 years stationed in Bentonville and then move on somewhere else. So there's been a huge amount of turnover in the Bentonville Jewish community. So they're kind of living on Walmart, but because of the nature of that business, they really haven't grown all that much. But they still have, probably after Little Rock, the second largest Sunday school in the state. Right, most other small town congregations in Arkansas, if they're still active, have a very, very small Sunday school, if no Sunday school at all. Yet Bentonville's is about 30 kids. So Etz Chaim's exception to the trend of the small town Jewish decline really is the exception that proves the rule. Right, it is the evidence of the replacement of the old Jewish merchant class by a new generation of Jewish professionals. It just so happens this major corporation happens to be located in a small town. That's the unusual part of it. Alright, so again, there's been a lot of attention paid to the shrinking, the dying southern Jewish community. But in fact, as this next wall of numbers will show you, there have never been more Jews living in the South than there are today. So I want to call your attention, this is Southern Jewish population based on estimates from the American Jewish Yearbook. So it's a consistent source, if not exactly accurate, but it's a good rough number. So you can see, in some cases, of these 11 states, in 5 cases, the Jewish population has declined since 1937, but in 6 states' cases, it has increased. And I want to call your attention to this bottom number. This is the total number of Southern Jews. So in 1937, there were about 193,000. In 2012, estimated 461,000. So the population of Southern Jews has more than doubled. And please note, there's no Florida in here. I am counting Northern Virginia and Texas. But but look at this number is the percent of U.S. Jewish population. So it was 4% of American Jews lived in the South in 1937. In 2012, it's almost 7%. So the portion of American Jews living in the South has increased. Now these trends, this growth trend, has taken place amidst a backdrop in which the American Jewish population has, by some accounts, shrunk and others has remained steady. So as the American Jewish population is shrinking, perhaps, the Southern Jewish population is increasing. South Carolina, as you see, is one of those states in which the population has grown. And the easiest way to understand Jewish demographics in the South is to look at which areas are thriving economically and which are languishing. As small-town economies have suffered, Jews have left for the booming Sunbelt metropolises of the South and beyond. And of course, the poster child, the best example of this is Atlanta. Atlanta emerges after the Civil War as a capital of the so-called New South, but it's really led the way during the Sun Belt era. It's a fast-growing city in general. It had its metro area had about 720,000 people in 1950. By 2000, it was over 4 million people living in the Atlanta metropolitan area. It's one of the fastest-growing cities in America. Still, the Jewish community of Atlanta, look at this chart, this is amazing, has grown even faster than the city itself. In 1948, Atlanta had about 10,000 Jews. In 1980, it had about 27,000 Jews. The last time they counted was 2006. There were over 120,000 Jews in and around the metropolitan Atlanta. And they came to Atlanta for the same reasons that Jews went anywhere: economic opportunity. Atlanta emerged from a railroad hub into an air travel hub. Because of its good transportation networks, its good climate, it's become a real corporate center. 700 of the Fortune 1000 companies have an office in Atlanta. And so as Jews are moving into the professions, as anti-Semitic restrictions are falling away, Jews are able to get jobs in law firms where previously they hadn't been able to get jobs, in corporations. Those jobs are in places like Atlanta. And you can see this in the increasing number of Jewish congregations in and around the city. In 1947, there were 6 Jewish congregations in Atlanta. So right after World War II, there were 6. I just counted them up just the other day. There are 42 Jewish congregations in and around Atlanta. Of these 42, 37 were founded after 1968, which is just a year before I was born, so that's recent history, as far as I'm concerned. Many new congregations are in the northern suburbs, places like Marietta, Dunwoody, and Alpharetta, where Jews realize that getting into 6 o'clock traffic to try to make Friday services is nuts. Let's form our congregation here in Alpharetta to avoid that. That'd be a great paper, The Impact of Traffic on Congregational Families. Atlanta would be a great place to study for that. Even more interesting is those far northern suburbs have really become a kind of cutting edge of the South's Jewish population. In the mid-90s, the Atlanta Jewish Federation didn't even recognize any significant Jewish population in these far northern suburbs. In 2004, they found over 16,000 Jews living in the northern suburbs like Alpharetta and Roswell. That's more Jews than live in all of South Carolina. That's more Jews than live in Alabama, Arkansas, and Mississippi combined. Right? So the question becomes, is this a southern community? What does that mean? According to the 2006 population study of Atlanta, only 19% of Atlanta Jews were born in Atlanta. 30% were born in New York. Almost a third of Jewish households had moved to the area in the past 10 years. So much for the notion of southern rootedness to place. Not so much. This is a good one, actually. A good chart. In those far northern suburbs, you have 7% were born in Greater Atlanta, 6% born in the former Soviet Union, 32% born in New York State. Atlanta, really since 1980, has emerged as a center for American Jewish life. It's one of the top 10 largest Jewish population centers in the country. And now, part of the growth is certainly due to folks like Carla Levingston, who moved from small towns in the South to Atlanta. But of course, more significantly is the increasing number of Jews moving there from the North and the Midwest, places where they probably would never have moved to 20 to 30 years prior. And Atlanta is just the most dramatic example, but certainly places like Houston, Dallas, Austin, Texas especially have seen tremendous growth in its Jewish community in the last 20 years. Nashville, Tennessee, Charlotte, North Carolina, all the Research Triangle area of North Carolina have experienced tremendous growth in their Jewish population. So if Jewish life is flourishing, can the same be said for Southern Jewish identity? Does that term Southern mean more than simply location, right? I mean, does it signify a set of cultural markers that set the Southern Jew off as distinct from Jews in the rest of the country? And certainly, in the Southern Jewish Historical Society, as Dale can attest, there's been great debates over this question of, are Southern Jews different from Jews elsewhere? And I don't want to get too far into that, but I want to discuss a few of these differences and look at how these demographic trends have affected them. right? One characteristic, I think, of Southern Jewish history has been the experience of living in smaller cities and small towns and smaller Jewish communities. I keep saying 1937 because that was the year of the best ever population study of American Jews. It was done by a guy named Harry Linfield. And in 1937, according to his sort of study, over half of Southern Jews lived amongst Jewish communities that had fewer than 5,000 people. Now, to my mind, 5,000 people is a big Jewish community. But if you look at, certainly New York, but, you know, many, many northern cities, that's a very, very small Jewish community. So over half of Southern Jews lived in essentially small Jewish communities. In other regions, like the West, 22% of Jews live in smaller communities. In the North, even excluding New York, that was an even smaller number. So Jews in the South were much more likely to live in a smaller community. In fact, Jews in the South were over four times as likely to live in a community of 100 or fewer Jews, that's a very small Jewish community, than those in other parts of the country, even not even counting New York City. Much more than in other regions, Jews in the South lived in smaller communities where they interacted with non-Jews as part of their daily life. In 1937, 42% of Georgia Jews lived outside of Atlanta. So Atlanta was still big, but 42% lived outside Atlanta. Today, less than 6% of Georgia Jews live outside of Atlanta. In fact, if you take Atlanta out of the equation, Georgia's Jewish population has shrunk over the last 50 years. The other issue that I want to talk about is the prominence of Reform Judaism. And I love this chart, although it makes people's eyes, but I'll explain it, because I spent a lot of time putting this chart together. And it's really important, if not so interesting. Traditionally, Southern Jews have been more attracted to Reform Judaism than Jews in other regions. In 1907, 38% of the members of the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, 38%, were located in the South, at a time when only 5% of American Jews lived in the South. So way overrepresented. Going through the old American Jewish yearbooks, I counted whether congregations were sort of Reform or sort of traditional / Orthodox. This is before the emergence of a kind of clear conservative movement. So congregations that were kind of conservative were usually lumped into the Orthodox field. So what you see by this is the darker the shade, the more predominance of Reform. So in Mississippi, you had 19 congregations, 15 were Reform. Right? South Carolina, you had 7, 4 were Reform, 3 were non-Reform or Orthodox. So you can see, as compared to other regions, how predominant kind of Reform was in the South. More numbers, just to prove my point. In 1917, 72% of Southern congregations used English in their worship services. In the rest of the country, 81% used Hebrew exclusively. Now, there are various reasons for this, various explanations for this. One would be the Jews who would settle in the South were perhaps less interested in maintaining traditional Jewish observance. Thus, they did not mind moving to a place where it might be harder to find kosher meat, for example. Also, I think Reform Judaism's de-emphasis on rigorous daily observance of rabbinic law made it especially suitable in the South, right? Where merchants had to keep their businesses open on Saturday in order to survive economically in many of these small towns. Also, I think, as a small minority of the population, Southern Jews were anxious to fit into their surroundings. Throughout the South, this meant adapting their religious practices to fit the prevailing, often Protestant norms. Thus, Reform Judaism, with its English prayers, Christian-based elements like choirs and organs and the confirmation ceremony, became quite popular in the Southern Bible Belt. Indeed, this predominance of Reform survives even today. A recent census of American synagogues found that 26% of American synagogues were Reformed. Yet in the South, it was 54%. And so Atlanta bucks this trend. Only a quarter of Atlanta synagogues are Reformed. There are many of those newly founded congregations in Atlanta are Orthodox and traditional, although they are small. So these figures suggest that at least religiously, Atlanta Jews are becoming a little different from Jews in other parts of the country. All right. So to conclude, we'll open it up to discussion. While the degree of Southern Jewish distinctiveness can be debated and will be debated by historians, what is undeniable is that the region and its Jews have become less distinct since the mid-20th century. One of the cultural effects of the rise of the Sun Belt has been the homogenization of the South. Travelers can drive through the southern metropolises on the interstate with little sense that they are in the South. The same chain restaurants, stores, and motels are everywhere. A similar process has transformed Southern Jewish life. Jews from the North have moved to southern cities, bringing their own religious and cultural traditions. Few Jewish children raised in Atlanta today speak in a southern accent. Once a universal signifier of Southern identity. And I can tell you that in my job, current job, not having a Mississippi accent has hurt me. I need to kind of cultivate one. I often get asked, where are you from? Texas, fortunately, is a good answer. I don't say New Jersey, because that would be terrible. So the northern-born suburban Jew living outside of Atlanta is more characteristic of contemporary Southern Jewish life than the small-town merchant in a place like Florence, South Carolina. Jewish families living in the suburbs of Atlanta are a little different from those living in the suburbs of, say, Chicago. So over the last several decades, as the rise of Jewish Atlanta indicates, the regions are now converging. Southern Judaism was once less orthodox, more assimilated, yet today Judaism is becoming more traditional in places like Atlanta. And there's little economic distinction between the Jewish professionals who live in Charlotte or Atlanta or Charleston than those who live in Boston or Chicago. And while Jews are still a smaller minority in the South, you know, Jews are a smaller percentage of the overall population in the South, these recent trends suggest that this too may be changing. As I said, there have never been more Jews living in the South than there are today. But as the American Jewish community is becoming more Southern, as we saw, the Southern Jewish community is becoming less distinctive. And so it's an open question as to where these trends are going to take us into the future. You know, will there continue to be a sort of distinctive Southern identity? Will there continue to be a distinctive South Carolina Jewish identity? And as I was thinking about this last night, after listening to the panel and seeing the film, it sort of occurred to me that, you know, we need not be so pessimistic about that. After all, who has done more to kind of establish this society and preserve the history of Jews in South Carolina than two Yankees, Dale Rosengarten and Marty Perlmutter? Right? So, perhaps that fact shows that, the fact that there are more and more Yankees moving down here might really be an opportunity for them. But anyway, I welcome your comments and your questions about this. We've got a little bit of time. I'll be happy to talk about it. I'd love to learn more about the South Carolina communities. You know, I've looked at some of the sort of numbers and try to see what's fitting into them. Or answer questions. Are there any? Yes, sir.
Charleston
is a growing Jewish community, by the way.
Yes. First of all, about 40 years ago, there was one Jewish professor at the Medical University. I've been told that there are over 200 Jewish professors at the Medical University today, so that's part of our growth.
Absolutely. That's another part of it, is that, for example, in Jackson, where I'm from, Jackson, Mississippi had a very small Jewish community up through World War II. Our congregation didn't have a full-time rabbi for many, many years. What's happened in Mississippi is Clarksdale, Greenville have shrunk as the merchants have left. Jackson has grown because Jackson is the medical center. It's the home of the medical school. It's the medical center. It's the legal center. So most of the other young Jewish families in Jackson either work for the Institute of Southern Jewish Life or work at the medical center. And so again, that shows, so places that are attracting Jewish professionals are growing or holding steady. And I'm sure a part of Charleston's growth, as you said, is the sort of, is the economic, is the medical economy here
The other side of the story in Charleston, I think it's different than other communities, is that we are losing population because we have an Orthodox community and an Orthodox day school, or community day school. But after the eighth grade, many of these children move on to other cities that have yeshivas and Jewish high schools to get their education. So when these children leave Charleston and go to the schools out of town, my daughter included, they settle in there. Large number of Orthodox Jews in bigger communities.
Yes.
So it's affected us negatively in numbers. I was told that Savannah, I don't know if this is true, but a prominent Savannah resident told me that there they have not had that effect as much as Charleston, because for some reason the children go straight into the business without going to college. But when they go to college, they have to meet elsewhere too. It loses.
College is a really important point. Like, I was in Oklahoma, and some guy told me that he forced his kids to go to college in state because he wanted them to come back and run the family business in Oklahoma City. And the idea was that if, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, if you can keep your kids, you know, if they go to college in state, they're more likely to stay. But in a lot of places where the kids go away for college, they go elsewhere. So I think there's truth to that. In terms of the day school, absolutely. I mean, that's been a real problem, I know, in New Orleans and in Memphis, where they haven't been able to keep rabbis, because once their kids get through the eighth grade day school, they don't have those resources. And so certainly to kind of maintain a strong Orthodox community, there needs to be infrastructure. And of infrastructure, you need to have numbers. So in terms of kosher restaurants and certainly day schools being a big part of that. Absolutely. That's one reason why Orthodox communities in smaller towns are probably never going to develop. Yes?
Well, my thought on looking at your figures are interesting. I live in Anderson.
Yeah, tell me about Anderson.
And Anderson's got a synagogue that's 100 years old. But I want to get back to the figures that you have.
Yeah.
We have 200 and something thousand Jews that live in Georgia.
125.
My question is, how many of those are affiliated with synagogues? Because my experience is that I don't care where you go, half of them are not going to be affiliated.
It's funny, Atlanta's rate of affiliation is very low. In fact, that's been a great challenge for the Atlanta institutional Jewish community is how do you get these people who are moving from other parts of the country and bring them into the community.
Right.
So that's another, of course, that's a national issue. And so while I don't have firm numbers on, Anderson, for example.
In other words, we got about 30 families, but 60 of them probably are there, but only 30.
Only half affiliated. So that's very interesting, is to what extent the rate of affiliation higher in smaller towns than in big cities? I would say, without any hard evidence to sort of back it up, that it probably did be higher in a smaller town. Because in Jackson, for example, if you want to be Jewish, there's only one way. That's to actually, be a member of Beth Israel. There's not a JCC, there's not any other institution that would be a means of affiliation. But, listen, the issue of affiliation with Jewish institutions is a national problem. And it's one that a lot of the Jewish foundational world and the Jewish leaders are wrestling with. And that's part of the Southern experience.
That might be another area to look into, because you're looking at just how many Jews are there.
Right, but how many are actually affiliated?
Being part of a synagogue, I'm interested in how many of them are actually affiliated.
Well, and David, who's a Jew? Right? 60 years ago, it was easy to tell who was a Jew. Nowadays, it's much more difficult, right? So what if somebody was raised Jewish, but they marry someone who's not Jewish, and they're not raising their kids as Jewish, maybe they go to the Episcopal Church. Do you count them?
No, they're not.
It's much more complicated now than it used to be.
I think they are,
but I don't. And by the way, those numbers look really scientific and precise, but they're not. Right? The way they do them is they basically get surveys that are done in larger cities, and frankly, they email people like us. Hey, how many Jews are in Jackson? Probably 600-700. Okay, that's the number. So again, they're sort of rough numbers. And if you ask the congregation in Jackson, folks have asked me last night, how many Jews live in Jackson? Well, that are affiliated with the synagogue is maybe 550. Well, how many Jews are not affiliated with the synagogue? Then you're just pulling numbers out of the air.
Well, to answer your other question, yeah. So what's going on at Anderson?
Yeah.
Anderson is fortunate enough to be right near Clemson University. So we have a university.
It's the university.
We have professors that's been doing our holiday services for over 30 years.
That's good.
So by having, we don't have a rabbi, but by having that affiliation, we're probably not going to be the typical synagogue in the way.
Right. That's interesting. And of course, one problem though with that is that academics are kind of notorious for not being the most affiliated folks. So sometimes, I've been in a lot of towns where there are academics who don't belong, but usually there's some. Well, like Charlottesville, Virginia was on the verge of closing back in the 1960s. And they were shrinking. They were the typical small town community. And the UVA began to hire a bunch of sort of Jewish academics, and now it's a thriving camp, you know, congregation. Yes, Rachel.
You look at these numbers, I'm putting on my Jewish, you know, our historical society.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about membership.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at the influx and the homogenization, you know, what's the trend for an organization like this going forward? Because that's what we're going to be looking at in strategic planning. The interests, the children, you know, I feel like we have to, these kids aren't coming back, or some may.
I mean, I thought Richard had a really good point last night, which is, you know, I mean, a lot of the focus of South Carolina Jewish history, quite understandably, has been the early kind of colonial and the Civil War period. But, you know, the fact that you have the growing number of Jewish lawyers and the growth of people from outside of the region moving in here, that's part of history, too. And, you know, those folks need to understand that their story is part of the story of South Carolina Jewry. And especially, you know, look, World War II was 60, 70 years ago. That's history. And so, you know, these post-World War II sort of, you know, kind of demographic changes are ones that need to be incorporated into our ideas of Southern Jewish history and of South Carolina Jewish history. I think that opens y'all up to, you know, Dale's presence in this state is historical.
Oh, my goodness.
Anyway, but yeah, I mean, that's a great challenge. You know, and I will tell you, I'm involved with a lot of historical societies. I'm on the board of a lot of historical societies. Every single historical society that I'm involved with has that exact same issue. How do we attract young members? I'm on the board of the Mississippi Historical Society, and I've just got appointed to a blue ribbon panel to address that issue. The Texas Jewish Historical Society, same issue. So, you know, that's something that a lot of people are trying to figure out. So that's not
unique.
Will
you share it with
me? Yeah. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Any other? Yes, sir.
Jewish anti-Semitism.
Yes.
Traditional, multi-generational Southern Jews accepting foreign Jews coming in.
Okay.
Is there a rise in opening of Jewish country clubs?
You know, it's interesting. Yeah, you know, certainly there's been a long tradition, especially in small towns. In fact, I argue that, or I would argue, that anti-Semitism was often more pronounced in larger cities because you could discriminate against a group, an abstract group of people. Oh, the Jews. In a place like Anderson, people know all the Jews. And so, you know, they respect those families. And so they're, you know, so that's my theory on that.
He's talking about anti-Semitism by Jews.
Oh, within the Jewish community. Well, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, the sort of model of Jewish life where first you had the sort of German Jewish established synagogue, then you had the influx of Eastern European Jews who established their own synagogues. That's what happened in Charleston and, you know, in bigger places. But in small towns, there weren't enough Jews to establish that second congregation. So in smaller communities, there was more of a need to get along. So I've seen less of a that internal anti-Semitism or tensions, ethnic tensions between the different groups of Jews, I think was often less pronounced in smaller communities simply because there weren't enough Jews to support Jewish congregations. So that would be my response to that. You know, what's interesting is there has been tremendous, in the last 10, 20 years, embrace of Jews, especially in rural parts, smaller parts of the South. I was in Lexington, Mississippi for Rosh Hashanah one year, about 10 years ago, and they don't have a rabbi in Lexington, but it was a lay-led service, and the sermon was given by a local doctor who's not Jewish, And he proceeded to talk about how the Bible had given all of Judea and Samaria to Jews, and Israel should basically take over the entire Middle East and kind of replace. I mean, it was like a maximalist, right-wing Zionist lecture given by this Christian doctor. It was a quintessential Mississippi experience. the question of anti-Semitism. But I will say that one of the important things, I think, for Jews everywhere was the visibility and prominence of Jews in these small towns, right? The fact that, that people in Gadsden, Alabama knew Jews and respected them, and that Jews in Gadsden were good citizens, was beneficial for Jews everywhere. And so one of the things that I think we're losing with the decline of these small communities is that presence. So, it's one thing to be all clustered in Atlanta, but it's good for the Jews if Jews are everywhere and their respective partners are Jews.
We'll do one or two more questions.
Great.
And then we'll also do a rescreening of the video that we first showed last night.
Great.
If anybody would like to see it again.
All right. One last question before we go to the film, although how can I compete with that? Well, thanks so much, everybody. I'm happy to stick around. And of course, Florida is a whole another part of the story.